Happy 2019. This is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. My name is Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are Molly Maloney and Eric Sturpe. Molly is the lead narrative designer at Bad Robot Games and can't talk about what she's working on. Previously, she was a lead gameplay designer at Telltale and worked on Guardians of the Galaxy, Minecraft Story Mode, Walking Dead, Season 3, Tales from the Borderlands, and before that, she was a concept artist at Backbone Entertainment. Eric was a writer at Telltale Games, where he worked on The Walking Dead Season 2, Tales from the Borderlands, Minecraft Story Mode Seasons 1 and 2, Batman the Telltale series. And since then, he's been a staff writer on the Netflix show Trash Truck, is currently helping write Fortnite, and is working as an interactive writing consultant for Echo. Thank you two for coming on.
And for coming back.
Yeah.
Whoa, those were such thoroughly researched backgrounds.
Thank you. So, Eric, you've been here before. We're not going to ask how you got into games again.
Okay.
Molly, how'd you get into game development?
And no, do you want the long version or the short version?
Do a long version.
Long version, you can just cut it out.
Sure.
So I went to school for classical Japanese linguistics and then realized that I'd made a huge mistake. And so as I was doing IT work to put myself through life, you know, to afford to live, I decided to have an amazing idea, which was that somebody had to make video games. And I've always loved them my whole life. And I was like, I could draw pictures for those, and that would make way more money than classical Japanese linguistics. Thought no one ever. And so naturally I did what anyone would do and dropped what I was doing in Wisconsin. I'm from Alaska originally, but I've just lived everywhere. And I moved to San Francisco and started doing an MFA in game design with an emphasis in concept art.
Where?
At a private institution in San Francisco that will go unnamed because I am deeply in debt. And I ended up getting hired out of school the minute I got offered my internship. Well, I did the internship, and then it turned into a full-time job. And then I immediately dropped out of school because I couldn't keep affording to go there. And then that company closed within 3 months, so I went back to school. And then Telltale hired me, and I dropped out of school again, and I never went back to school. So that's kind of the weird how I kind of got into it. I really wanted to do it, though. I've always played video games. As a kid, I played the Infocom text-based games, because Anchorage is 20 years behind the rest of the world at all times. And I don't know. I just really liked them, so.
Has your Japanese linguistics background been useful at all?
It's enriching in the soul. I'm really glad I got to read a lot of the books that I read, and but I, you know, you forget so much. So it came in useful when we went on vacation the other year.
Yeah, we went to Japan last fall. We're not married, by the way, in case that's a thing that hasn't come up yet.
We're married.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I can speak. I like to say I can speak these days enough Japanese to talk about boys, but like not enough to talk about politics.
I just realized, like, how'd you become a narrative designer? Because I feel like for game writing, like, that's even a harder one to get into. Like, game writing's easier to get into than narrative design. I think it's harder to explain how you would become a narrative designer.
Well, it's so funny too. I never would have dreamed of being a narrative designer. It wasn't like ever in the cards for me. I always drew pictures as a young person. I guess I'm still a young person, but so drawing pictures for games, that made sense. Somebody's got to come up with the zombies and stuff, and I thought, okay, I can do that. But working at Telltale, actually, I made a ton of friends. The concept artists at Telltale worked very closely with the narrative design department because through some pipeline process, usually the concept art team, somebody's going to bust me for this, but in my experience, the concept art team did a lot of the top-down layout work, which at many studios would be a game design requirement, but concept just handled it. So I ended up working with a lot of the narrative designers, and most you introduced me as a gameplay designer, but honestly most of us were just narrative designers. Like I did gameplay, but as a narrative company. So anyway, as a concept artist, I worked with a lot of the narrative designers, became friends with them, and then over time I realized that, you know, like I care very much about stories, storytelling, and I was really fortunate to work on a title called Tales from the Borderlands, and the leadership team on that was way too kind to me, considering how uppity and what a pain in the butt I was. And So they ended up giving me more responsibilities. And by the end, between that and knowing the narrative designers and what they did, honestly, narrative design in so many ways is like concept art without drawing the pictures. I always like to say that half of concept art is thought, you know, like coming up with something that is sensible to what you're making, that, you know, ticks all these boxes and does the things, works in the engine. Narrative design is just that for a story without the pictures. And so at the end of Borderlands, I took the design test and they let me in. But I never would have thought of it if I hadn't been friends with those guys. Like, it never even occurred to me as a career path.
Yeah, and the thing that Molly's being too modest to say right now is that by the end of her time on Tales from Borderlands, she was actually an assistant director for the series. And I think that was a huge part of that transition as well, because, you know, because the assistant director was not only involved in the art and cinematic side of things and the directing, but also really involved in the story and development. And so it's just one of those things that then, you know, having spent all this time doing that, like, I think when the conversation came up of like, hey, could we see Molly being a narrative designer, everyone was like, well, yeah, duh.
He has to say that. He's my husband.
All right, Eric.
Yeah.
Could you talk about what you've been up to since you were last on here, which was in March 2016?
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's been a while. So I think since March 2016, I can't remember if I'd worked on Batman by that point, but I was probably, like, either in the middle of Batman or just about to do Batman. But, yeah, so I did Batman at Telltale, and then the last five episodes of Minecraft Story Mode through 2017, which was a great, really great experience. And then Molly and I moved down here to Los Angeles in...
We got married in between.
Yeah, and then we got married in between there, too. We moved down to Los Angeles in September, like late September, early October of this past year. We came down here for Molly's work and it kind of seemed like the right time to try and pursue doing the, you know, freelance work. I've been really lucky that, you know, I'd been working with folks, you know, like you mentioned, like I'd worked with Netflix Animation. That was a gig that I'd been doing on the side, and I'd been kind of talking to other folks. And so I said, you know, maybe now's the right time. And so I came down here, and I've been really, really lucky that I've been working with the team at Epic on the story mode for Fortnite, which has been a really fun and goofy experience. And then things like Netflix, and I've been working with a group called Echo, who's trying to do interactive video. And so I've been kind of doing the whole interactive consulting thing, which is fascinating because there's so much. It's a weird time where there's all these people trying to get in on the interactive, like, branching story stuff, and so few people that actually really know what goes into that. And
well, it's such an untested area.
Yeah, and it's like, and I think it's fascinating because there are so few examples that people can point to as reference. And it's like, and Molly and I talk about this all the time, where it's so frustrating that choose your own adventure books are one of the few things that kind of everyone knows and recognizes, because that's actually not a great example of, like, really compelling narrative design. But it's like the one thing that you can sort of say, like, you know, oh yeah, like, it's a choose your own adventure book, and, you know, 98%
everyone
of people
remembers.
Go, oh yeah, I remember those. Yeah, and so that was kind of a long, rambling way of saying I've been kind of doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And
you gave a GDC talk.
That's right.
You went to Norway.
Mm-hmm.
You've been a busy bee.
Yeah, it was cool. Molly and I would have never been the type to think about doing a GDC talk, but it was, we got talking about it for GDC 2018. Like, at the end of 2017, we're like, you know, we're planning a wedding. We don't have enough we don't have enough going on right now.
Do you ever feel like you have a hole in your life?
but we had this idea for a GDC talk called Writing and Narrative Design, a Relationship, where we had just had a lot of conversations with folks about, like, you know, I'm a writer, she's a narrative designer. How does that work? What's it like working with the person that you're, you know, at the time engaged to? And so it kind of became this GDC talk that was super fun, and they accepted it. And then we actually were able to take that talk to another conference called Console in Norway, which was a great time.
Shout out to Console. They're amazing. Yeah. If you're ever in Norway in October, go. You should be in Norway in October. It's great. It's beautiful.
Yes, yeah, so that's kind of a long, rambling way of saying, yeah.
You're doing stuff.
Yeah, stuff.
We'll get to your talk in a bit, right after this question, but because we haven't had a lot of... Telltale's not like a AAA studio, but it's close
double
to a AAA.
We always like to call it AA.
But you don't have a lot of writers like that who go from working there and then go into freelancing. It's usually like freelancing then goes up to AA or AAA mm-hmm. writing. So have you found freelancing so far?
It's been, yeah, I was at Telltale for 5 years, so you get really used to just sort of having that regular paycheck coming in. And
sounds nice.
Yeah. Well, and then anything else coming in is sort of just gravy, with it, where it's like, you know, I was really fortunate that I got to do some side gigs when I was at Telltale, so I was like, I had that, you know, I had that steady salary, and then also, like, the side stuff. And so now suddenly going to like freelancing where it's like it's much more piecemeal, where like I'll have weeks that are really slammed and then I'll have, like a month where there's nothing going on. And when we first
our apartment has never been cleaner though. I love it.
Yeah, what was so funny was it was like the first probably 2 months. Well, so the first month, like, I was like, you know, it's the excitement of moving in and I was unpacking everything and that was great. And I had enough like little gigs here and there to kind of keep me busy. And then like month two, I think, was probably the hardest on you, Molly, just because like I was at my absolute craziest where I was like, I'm never going to work again. This is terrible. This is awful.
I love you, but you were a basket case.
I was a little bit of a basket case. But no, I think I'm finally settling into it where I'm finally getting better at saying like, okay, the weeks that I don't have anything, that's a great time to catch up on writing stuff for myself, getting my samples in order, because I think that's something I didn't fully appreciate enough when I was at Telltale, was just that experience of, like, I need to always have new samples ready to go.
And also, you know, just ingesting and marinating on media, you know, you actually get to read things for fun. Like, it's the little things, like having hobbies. Like, I feel like those things make you a better writer.
Yeah, no, that was something that, again, like, those first 2 weeks, or those first, like, 2 months, I was really bad at, like, actually remembering to consume things. And I think I've gotten much better at being like, oh, for my lunch break, I should actually watch something or, like, read something. And
I felt like in the beginning you thought that if you enjoyed something, I would perceive you as being at home eating bonbons. And I feel like that's really tapered off. And I think you've been better for it.
Yeah. So the freelance thing has been very exciting. And you know, a lot of ups and downs. But I think what I like about it is now that I've kind of been able to embrace like the short term nature of stuff, it's cool to just kind of get a chance to work with different people. And I feel really, really lucky that I've been able to work on like some interactive stuff, some non interactive stuff. And yeah, again, it's just one of those nice convergence moments where there are people that are like being like, oh, let's talk about interactive things. And, you know, that's something that thankfully I've had like 5 years experience thinking about that. And so it's hilarious because I'll go into some place that's like, we're thinking about doing an interactive thing. And I'm just able to be like, well, here's kind of how we did it at Telltale for 5 years. And just people being like, wow, I never thought about it that way. And so in some ways it makes me feel, I like being able to share that knowledge, because I think at Telltale it was really easy to feel like, I think at Telltale we really took for granted the fact that we were thinking about that stuff at a really kind of high level. That's what we were doing every single day. Because now talking to folks who are interested in doing our interactive that had never done it before, it's like, oh, that knowledge that we were cultivating, that's actually like useful to some people, which I never would have expected.
It's funny, Telltale was kind of like, I didn't think about it at the time, but it was almost like an R&D think tank for choice space. Like, we had one core mechanic, right? And we basically doubled down on it for years. But, like, that's weirdly, it's like almost in an educational sense or a, like, posterity thing. I don't know, it's kind of valuable.
Yeah, and I think that's what was so fascinating about that time at Telltale was it was just this period of time where it was every single department, animation, cinematics, writing, design, everybody, all focused on saying, okay, how do we make like dialogue choice-based stuff work? And so like the conversations I've had with even like directors being like, okay, here's how you direct when the choices are on screen, here's how you frame the shot to make sure the player knows who their player character
Imagine
is.
Imagine for 5 years only being able to paint with the color red. Like, it's kind of like that, right? Like, it's just like, well, we find new ways to spice up red.
Do you think, after 5 years of just using red, do you think you've done everything you can do with red?
I have a really nostalgic attachment to red. Like, I always believe, I love choice spaces. Like, Telltale was a dream job for me. I was a big fan of BioWare games for the same reason. You know, Knights of the Old Republic was my first big game that made me say, like, oh my gosh, I could do this. So getting to work for a company that emphasized player choices was one of the most exciting things. Even at that time when I was a concept artist and I didn't know I was going to be a narrative designer, I thought that was amazing. So I still want to use red, you know, but I still believe, like, there's so much about red we don't understand, and there are new ways to use it, and
could you give an example?
Oh, God. Off the top of my head? You mean about how we can use choice space in a way that we haven't seen it before?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, one of the things that I find really interesting is Telltale was well known for pioneering the dialogue timer in The Walking Dead. And before that, if you were making a choice, it would just hang there, you know, and wait for you. As our old CEO would say, you could get up and go make a sandwich and the game would not stop, or would stop for you. And It's interesting. I was a true believer of the timer. Like, I think it added a pressure that kind of forced you to be there in the moment. But the side effect that I increasingly encountered with the timer was that it made the gameplay itself, where you could, the timer necessitates something to happen when you dead stick, when you don't press a button, which means you need a silent option, which means you can walk away from the game. And weirdly, the same thing happens as making the sandwich, in that the game plays itself for you. So one of the things that I think is interesting that I would like to revisit about dialogue choices is that waiting for the player to speak. Is there a way for a game to do that thing that Knights of the Old Republic or Mass Effect did, where you would just hang there, but it didn't feel so horrible? You know, like, is there a middle ground that doesn't involve a 20-minute idle conversation between the characters talking about everything while they're waiting for you to answer that feels right? Like, this is something that I have gone back and forth on a lot, and I'm talking about it out loud because I still don't have the answer.
Well, and I think, yeah, it's interesting. Molly and I both showed up at Telltale right as Walking Dead Season 1 was wrapping and the DLC 400 Days was coming out.
Yeah.
And so we really got to be there for that 5-year, like, post-Walking Dead period, where it was just this, like, constant analyzation of, like, what worked, like, and how do we recreate that? And I think a big part of that was trying to figure out, like, the prescriptive, like, every choice is this. Like, it is always 3 choices and a silent. It is always, like, a 7 to 10 second timer. And I think what was cool was by the end of our time at Telltale, there was starting to be a little bit more experimentation with, like, okay, well, maybe sometimes it's 2 choices, sometimes it's 3 choices, sometimes it's 5 choices.
Well, it took so long for me to perfect. Like, there's a real art to figuring out what a great choice space is and what feels good and how to tee the player up psychologically to want to do something and either choose to subvert that expectation or provide that on the wheel. And then once you figure that out, and that is not to say that I have cracked the nut, but I at least felt like I was starting to understand it, then you start looking for ways to mess around with that and keep it interesting for you. Once you understand the rules, you want to break them. And I feel like I was just starting to figure out how to break them.
Well, and I think that's been really interesting about, like, the work that I've been doing now, like, kind of doing this freelancing stuff, you know, with other people and the choice-based things, is realizing, like, oh, there's a lot of times where you can't have, you know, like, trying to do a one-size-fits-all choice is kind of an extra, like, that you, it will feel stale. And so, like, kind of learning, like, oh, sometimes it feels really great to have just a binary choice with no timer. Sometimes it feels great to have 4 choices with a timer.
A Witcher does that really great.
Witcher does that really well.
I was initially so mad that they would, like, occasionally have a timer and occasionally not. And I was like, pick a lane. But, like, as you play it, you're like, no, sometimes it feels good to have a timer and sometimes it don't.
It makes the timer more impactful when it does happen.
Yeah, exactly. It, like, puts the pressure. And not every choice needs to make you feel pressure. Like, when you're picking the difference between, what was it, cereal and Bandersnatch, I don't need pressure for that choice. Like, I'm going to think about my Wheaties. But other ones, like, if I'm in a fight with somebody, I do want pressure. That makes sense. I would be pressured. So yeah, it's just kind of interesting to think about. So anyway, I think there's a lot left to do with the color red, and we could probably talk about that forever.
Yeah, we'll get more into Telltale in a bit. I'm gonna backtrack back to GDC because I said I would go back to it like 10 minutes ago. So could you two talk a little bit about the talk that you gave at GDC? Like, it's about the marriage of writing and narrative design together.
Mm-hmm. So at Telltale, we worked together specifically on a couple episodes of Minecraft Story Mode, and then we were working together on, before we left and before Telltale closed, we were working on Stranger Things together. And we had started to realize that, like, we had been seeing the way that our personal relationship and the fact that we had a personal relationship was, like, reflected in how we were working together as a writer and narrative design duo. And then we saw the way that, like, working together forced us to, you know, confront head-on, like, communication problems we might have been having, both professionally and personally. And we realized it was, like, this big learning experience that I think made us both better coming out of the end of it. And so the talk kind of ended up being a little bit of a chronicling of that experience.
Well, that was the thing, like, we couldn't hide from misunderstandings and frustrations when you're dating the person that you're co-lead with. Mm-hmm. I think this is why people break up when they work together, right? Like, so we'd fight or even worse than fighting, one of us would be annoyed with the other but not say it out loud, as is the case. I mean, I feel like you guys uniquely can understand this, right? When you work with somebody you love, sometimes they step on your toes or piss you off or do whatever, and on my natural inclination, or both of ours, I suppose, mm-hmm. Probably more so even yours than mine, but would be to swallow it and just kind of let it go. Mm-hmm. And then you go home and you find yourself weirdly resentful of the person.
Why do I feel angry this
evening? And you don't want to talk about your day. And basically, it ended up with a lot of awkward conversations between us where we kind of had to talk about our working styles professionally in order to get through to our personal life. And we started, over time we got past that, we started laughing about it. Like, we got a lot healthier through doing it, but then we realized a lot of the, Telltale would always pair narrative designers with writers together, but you wouldn't always have a say in the pairing. So you might be paired with somebody who you had no say in being paired with. And you'd see that work really well sometimes, but you'd see it work really poorly sometimes. And that was one of the things we identified that culminated us in designing the talk was a great working relationship is very similar to a great personal relationship. You have to be open. You have to be honest. You have to communicate. You have to say when something's bothering you, but you don't say it in a way that, like, you know, hurts the other person's feelings and all of that touchy-feely stuff. And well, we made a talk out of that.
and it was funny because I distinctly remember, like, we had a period of time where we were almost, we joked, it was almost like we were doing relationship coaching for some of these writer-designer pairs where, you know, because by the end of our time at Telltale, we were two of the more senior folks in our respective departments. And so we'd be talking to the more junior folks who were just like, I can't stop fighting with my designer, or I can't stop fighting with my writer. And so we'd be having these conversations with them about, like, how to communicate and, like,
how does that make you feel?
And how to pick the lanes. And I think it was after a couple of times coming home being like, man, I had this conversation with so-and-so today about this. We're like, this feels like there's a talk or something here in it. And that was kind of really where it came from.
It was funny because it felt really obvious to us, like maybe people wouldn't want that kind of advice in a way. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, well, you know, communicate well and, you know, don't be a dick to each other. But we somehow made it into a talk that was about half an hour long. And I think people seemed to laugh.
And what was hilarious was, so we gave it a GDC and then a console. And those both being for games crowds, like, the thesis statement of the talk felt a little bit more like, hey, like, don't always stomp on the writer. Sometimes the writer has decent ideas.
Game stomps on writers a lot.
What was hilarious was then when we brought it, so I, during the period of time I was working at Netflix, they asked if we'd come in and give the talk again for the Netflix Interactive crew. And so
it was so weird.
And it was really funny because we're in there and the parts of the talk that are like, sometimes story is important, and it's all these.
We,
like,
finally had to, like, stop and be like, okay, we're gonna go off book on this because, like, you have to understand games is different.
Yeah, and so we actually ended up rewriting a pretty decent chunk of the talk to be a little bit more like almost flipping it to be like, hey, writers,
design matters.
Yeah, making choices makes interactive things feel good.
Yeah.
Do you think marrying narrative designers and writers, like pairing together, is a good thing that other studios should do?
Yeah, I think so it's funny. It's going to sound almost a little sacrilegious, sounds dramatic, but, like, we've talked about this a lot since leaving Telltale and since Telltale closed, but it's like, I think
that's RIP.
Never forget.
And what's funny is I think in that narrative design writer relationship, I think having a pairing is awesome, and I think, like, one of the thesis statements of our talk was, like, having a narrative designer and a writer means, like, the narrative designer is looking out for the player and the, you know, and the narrative and the writer is looking out for the characters. And that's awesome. If there's something I've learned, it's that writing does kind of need to know when to take a backseat occasionally, because I think because if there's one thing I've learned in games, it's that players will completely forgive bad writing moments way more than they'll forgive bad narrative design moments, is a thing I've kind of realized.
Gets taken through the ringer. I mean, it's a fundamentally participatory experience. So when you don't feel agency over what you're doing, if you don't feel like you're doing enough or what you're doing doesn't feel right to the moment, it takes you out. Yeah. Whereas somebody saying a corny line, I know people in my life who say corny lines all the time. I gloss past it. Like, you know, like, I feel like people forgive in a different way.
Yeah, it's funny. Molly uses this term of a frustration bucket. Where it's kind of the idea of, like, you know, sort of what leads.
I stole it from somebody, and I can't remember who. I feel like we should attribute that person, but I can't remember who.
They're
was.
Out there somewhere.
Whoever you are, thank you.
But yeah, Molly uses the term of the frustration bucket, where it's the idea that, like, you know, when the bucket flows over with frustration, that's when the person either, you know, they rage quits or they don't come back to a game. And I think something I've realized is, like, okay, yeah, like, you know, a bad line of dialogue, that's going to be a couple drops in the bucket. But, like, that's nothing compared to, like, a moment when, like, the player doesn't feel like they're in control or the player feels like they're being forced to do something they don't want to. Like, that's a whole couple cups of water in the frustration bucket. think I'm mixing metaphors.
Whatever, it's fine. You're doing great. But I will say, you know, the thing that always has me coming back to it, I'm 100% in alignment with you. I think that pairing them together is great. Like, I honestly think I did better design being paired with even a stubborn writer, you know, because it forces you to think outside the box. And vice versa, I would hope. But the thing about it is that I always come back to, and this is a little different from the talk, I feel like I'm always evolving as a designer, and so my point of view continues to evolve and change. But I do think that design should maybe, it hurts to say it, maybe have a little more say. And the only reason I say that is I think it's very delicate. There should be checks and balances, because I think one of the magical things about Telltale was that writing and design were on equal footing. And I'll never stop believing that, because I think it made our stories phenomenal. But the thing about it is a video game is different from reading a book, is different from watching a movie or a show. You know, the player is a character, and we have to keep acknowledging that. And when you can find a writer who also acknowledges that, that's the jam. Like, that's the best. But if you can't, you know, if you're both, like, solidly in your own discipline, then serving as checks and balances and having somebody to say, okay, but that's an amazing story point. How do we make it playable? That's so incredibly valuable. And the interchange of those two departments, because I've seen a lot of game studios that they don't talk quite as much as I feel like they should. And I think that's special.
Well, and I think it's funny. I think kind of one of the secret sauce elements at Telltale was on every episode, you had your writer, you had your designer, and you also had your director for the episode. And, like, the director in so many instances was the person who kind of did serve as the, like, third party for, you know, for arguments between writing and design.
Tiebreaker, but also an amazing vision holder.
Yeah, and the best directors at Telltale were people who were also bringing really, really strong chops in both the writing and narrative design side of things.
Great director could do both in small ways.
Yeah, and so that's something I think was really valuable was, like, if there were times where the writer and designer were really butting heads, it was kind of the director who would come in and be like, okay, what's really important that neither of you are looking at right now is actually this is what we need to do.
Yeah, exactly. They'd cut down the middle. And sometimes one of my favorite directors, John, would always say, we don't even need lines for that. Like, why are you even doing that? Like, we'll just show it. It's fine. Move on. And I'm just like, damn it, why didn't I think of that? So also, yeah, I think the director slot at Telltale doesn't get enough props. We certainly didn't give it enough props in our talk.
We're talking about Telltale now, so we'll just go into Telltale officially. Mm-hmm. Since we haven't really talked about it on our podcast since the studio shut down. In both of your opinions, why was the storytelling at Telltale generally so much better than a lot of other games out there? Because it wasn't just that they had great writers and great narrative designers, because a lot of other studios have great writers and narrative designers, and they'll still release games without good storytelling. Like, it's not because of them.
It really isn't. Like, I've known so many amazing, talented people who, you know, if there's one thing I feel like I understand from video game development, it's you can have the best team, and sometimes it just doesn't work out. And I would say there were many times at Telltale where it didn't work out either.
The thing I was going to say is I think it really just fundamentally comes down to something Molly said earlier, which was, you know, dialogue choices and story were the core mechanic at Telltale, and so that's just what everyone was devoted to, from programming to animation to cinematics to writing and design. Everyone was just trying to make a good story, and I think at the end of the day, I think Telltale ran closer to being like an animation studio that made animated interactive things, you know, that, and I think that was a big part of it, was everyone was in there day to day just trying to tell really good stories. And it is one of those things where I think it was just that utter focus on story, and kind of everything else fell by the wayside.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like, I think it's a combination of we move very quickly, so obviously there was a lot of great ownership. I actually had the perfect answer to this question, and now it's completely gone. But we moved really quickly. We had a very fast development cycle, and one of the great things about that meant you kind of had to go on gut a lot of the time, which your gut can so let you down. But also, a lot of, like, the most heartfelt experiences come straight from the gut, and because sometimes your first draft was the only draft. It had this rawness that I feel like it varied, you know, from project to project. But I feel like that was a big part of one of the things that made it magical. I also think, oh, this was what I was going to say. Because of the fact that we were choice-based fundamentally, and I think everybody in the studio is pretty behind that, it was, you never had to justify why the story needed to be good or why, because everybody knew that that was the core mechanic. The story was the core mechanic. So, and I see you guys smiling, and I feel like everybody can recognize, like, how often you have to justify why stories should
sounds
be good.
Sounds so nice.
I took it for granted so much, too. You know, like, I took it for granted. And but you could walk into a room and just say, like, there were times, especially when the team had your back. Like, there are those magical times. I'm getting goosebumps. There's magical times where you're all behind making something, and it's churning out, and you believe it. It's hard, but it's coming together. And you walk into a room, and you're just like, we need to do this because it's going to be good. Like, it's going to make it better. And, like, you see your leads look at you, and you know they agree. And it's just like, oh, I'm getting goosebumps, you guys. Like, that was the magic, where that was good enough.
No, and I think that is the thing that would happen, is, like, you'd have these times where someone would have a great idea. So you'd get a meeting together with all your leads, and you'd pitch something that then would be in the game 3 weeks later. Like, you know, and I think that was kind of the most incredible thing. And I think to kind of come back to what Molly was saying about the rawness, like, so we were just at the Largo Theater here in Los Angeles not too long ago, actually just this past weekend, and got to see some comedians working out, like, really new raw material. And what's interesting about that is it's, like, it was very unrehearsed. There was a lot of sloppiness. It was really uneven. But there was a real, like, heartfeltness that came through there that made it feel really special. And I think Telltale had a lot of that, too, where it's, like, the dialogue that characters would be saying, like, it's kind of uncomfortable for me to go back and look at, like, Minecraft Story Mode, for instance, where it's, like, the second season, I wrote a lot of that one, and
at our house at 2 a.m.
And I look back at that one, and it makes me really uncomfortable sometimes, because it is such a reflection of things I was working through at that period of time in my personal life, where it's things like, you look at Minecraft Story Mode, and it's just all this, like, I wish I could say subtext, but often just a very obvious text about, like, being uncomfortable about like changing status in life, and like what does it mean to be a leader, and what does it mean to open up to people, and it's all this stuff I was dealing with in my personal life that was just kind of dumped onto the page because I was like, well, this needs to be written by tomorrow, so I guess I better just put in what I'm feeling, and I think that's really what Telltale had, was it was like it was grueling at times, but yeah, it was a place where people were just kind of putting whatever was like just in their hearts immediately onto the page, and it was such a short translation period that I think it was this odd experience of getting to see, like, just, you know, stuff ending up, even when it was from a ton of different people, like it's funny, I talk to people about Tales from the Borderlands in particular, and like the themes that they really connect with on that, where it's like, you know, the thing I hear from people that they liked about that series was they really liked that it was like, oh, it's like this ragtag family who's like just trying to get by in a difficult time, and it's all about not knowing what to do, and just going with your gut and hoping that things will be
trusting
okay.
Trusting and friendships.
And I'm like, man, that is literally exactly what the entire team making that game was going through at the time.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's what made it special. It was this odd alchemy of short development cycles and people who were just, for lack of time, just throwing everything they had at the page.
This is kind of related to my next question. What were your favorite experiences over there?
Oh, man. I built a box fort at 1 a.m. with my producer. That was pretty fun. Gosh, there's so many good experiences that I can't even begin to count them. I remember sitting, we only owned half the building. We didn't even own half the building. I missed the old building. I never worked at the old building, but I used to hear these amazing stories where they apparently had a room that still had asbestos in it, and they called it Narnia. And when they had no room for meetings, they would go hang out in Narnia and discuss things in the asbestos room. I missed that room. I missed that whole office, but I don't have cancer now, so that's good. That I know of. But, like, there's so many great experiences. So I remember squatting in... So we only owned half of the building when I worked there. We moved... It was funny. Telltale moved into the building a month before I got hired, and they closed a month after I left. So I feel like I just, like, lived my life in this one building. And we spilled... During Tales from the Borderlands, we would spill into... there was just too many of us and not enough room, and so we'd end up squatting in the part of the building that we weren't renting sometimes. And Kevin Bruner, our CEO, would get so mad. And I was working on the intro for episode 3 of Tales from the Borderlands with Nick, our director, and we were like listening to the music that we were going to set it to, and we had a whiteboard, and I was still a concept artist, so we were storyboarding like how that would look and having the time of our life. And then like Kevin like comes around the corner. It's like this open, it's hard to describe the room, but he like pokes his head in and he's like furious. And then he sees Nick, who had worked there since he was 17 and was basically a son. And he just like looks at Nick and he's just like, and then just disappears again. And Nick is like, we have to leave. So it was like stuff like that. You know, it was amazing. I remember karate chopping a chocolate bowl, like when we had a dessert day. We remember hanging out on the deck and watching fireworks because the Marin County festival, like the county fair would be, you could hear people performing from the county fair from our deck. So we just eat ice cream and watch the fireworks and listen to like the old Beach Boys, whatever's left of the Beach Boys, singing something. Like, there's just so many great things. But also working with people making games was also really great. Amazing conversations.
Yeah, and it's funny. There was that period of time at Telltale that it almost felt like it was like this bizarro sequel to college, where because the San Francisco area was so expensive, people all ended up living very close to each other because like one person would find a cheap area to live or like an apartment complex or something. And so then the minute new employees are showing up, like, where should I live? It's like, well, these people found a cheap area to live over here. And so you'd end up
quickly.
And so you'd end up with these pockets where it was all these Telltale people living close to each other. And it was all kind of clustered around the office.
Stumble around to each other's apartments. Like,
and especially in those like days of like Wolf Among Us and Tales from the Borderlands, like everyone was working these really long hours. And, you know, it was really common for people to be leaving and, you know, and be like, oh, man, what a long day. Do you want to go grab a couple of drinks?
Get sushi.
And so it was this period of time where it was, again, I'm sure, just in hindsight, very unhealthy to be doing it. But, like,
it was like, I feel like it was a symptom because we hired a lot of people out of college. So we had a lot of young people. I was a young person.
Are a young person, Molly.
I am a young person.
You're an even younger person.
I was young and thriving. I was in my prime. No, a lot of young people working at Telltale, which I feel like they naturally solidify and like group together and do social stuff. You know, we were a lot of single people before I met my husband at my job, which is another indicative red flag of overworking. But so my point is, like, it was a very family kind of atmosphere. People were very tight. But it was also just, you know, you hear a lot of stories of crunch, and we definitely experienced that. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I was building a box fort at 1 a.m. on a Saturday for a reason. But, you know, like my buddy Steve, he had his bass guitar, and he would play it at 5 o'clock in the evening, like, while we were hanging out, just riffing on ideas. Like, for every crazy moment, there was always, like, a very fun, chill moment to pair with it. And I always remember, regardless of what project I was on, I knew that I could wander around our floors and find somebody to spitball with who would be filled with amazing ideas, even if we weren't on the same thing. People that I just wanted to spend my time with. I don't know if I'll ever again have the opportunity to work with so many people who I implicitly trusted. And just, I mean, our wedding was a Telltale event. Like, yeah. It was almost entirely, like, great friends. Amazing, wonderful people who cared so much about stories.
I'm going to get into a slightly more complicated question. What was good about Telltale's production process? What was bad about it? Because this is kind of a unique situation where, like, on this podcast and in general, a lot of times developers cannot be honest about game development for obvious reasons. And now that Telltale's gone, especially like right after on Twitter, people could tell stories that maybe were shocking to people who aren't in game development.
Do you want to talk about something that you like first?
Actually, it's kind of a good and bad thing about Telltale. So I think something that gets glossed over a lot in a lot of the articles and postmortems that have come out about Telltale is it was a company that was so different project to project. And because the projects were really kind of run in very siloed environments where like, you know, you'd sort of have people staffed to this project or that project. And a lot of that came out of the fact that there was a period of time, like, you know, during that like Borderlands Wolf Among Us phase where you would have people, there was a big problem with people really getting worn thin because they were getting yanked from project to project to project. Like, if someone was good, you know, they'd be like, okay, you're going to work a crunch week on this project. Now you're going to work a crunch week on this project. Now back to this project. And so in order to combat that, they said, okay, we're starting up all these new projects, and we're going to really silo them off from each other. And so I think that's something that I've noticed a lot in the postmortems and the articles people have written about Telltale, is it feels like there were a lot of stories told from like some of the unhealthier projects, and just like because I think there were a lot of projects that did find a way to, amongst the craziness, feel satisfied and feel good about things. And so I think I have a lot of mixed feelings, because on the one hand, it's a bummer that when things started siloing more, it meant you had less of what Molly was talking about, like the cross collaboration between projects. Like, that was so exciting. But I think on the other hand, when projects felt like they were really kind of like, when I felt like a project was kind of like its own mini company, I feel like that gave people that sense of like, I feel like when it was a healthy project, it could build that sense of camaraderie really effectively. Like, just that feeling of like, we are like, you know, they kind of team this or team that. And it was a bummer when that became competitive, but I really liked that. So like, for instance, I had a really positive experience on Minecraft Story Mode Season 2. We had a really wonderful executive producer on there, Mark Dickinson, who he created an atmosphere that we were really, really proud of that project. We were always on time. Like, you know, that we always tried to make sure that people didn't work, you know, didn't overwork too much. And I think that's something that I both, like, that's something I like, in that, you know, there was the chance for people to really make a difference on their projects. But it's a bummer that, I guess it's just a bummer that that's something that can kind of get lost sometimes, that, you know, that I think there were, like, it was really hard, the fact that some projects were so much healthier than others. That was kind of a rambling answer. I hope there was something in there.
I think it's interesting, like, I really love the production team. I've known people who have said, you know, you can't be friends with your producers, they're the enemy. I've literally heard this said. Our producer, Chris Vossen, read a poem that he wrote for us at our wedding. So, you know, I love I love producers, and I don't know how I'd do my job without them. Like, I am very action-focused, you know? Like, I'm constantly in the moment trying to put out fires or do deliverables, and production has always, Telltale was always an incredible asset. However, you know, there is a double-edged sword. And so I have very complicated feelings on this, because I've seen the Twitter accounts and I've seen, like, you know, what everybody said. And I'm not here to say that those stories aren't true, because they're not. They're true, whatever the good one is. I'm not saying they're not true. I think I did that right. They're true. But I think everybody has their own personal experience, and what I have to say does not change what other people have felt. I was fortunate to always have really great experience with my production staff. That was not to say that it was not an extreme challenge from time to time. We had very extraordinary deadlines, and to the point where, you know, friends of mine would on the production staff, you know, would acknowledge the difficulty, let's say, of achieving the goals. I'm trying so hard to be diplomatic about a company that doesn't even exist anymore. The way it was sometimes things were out of your control, you know, and it came from a higher up level, a level that I wasn't privy to. But I think one of the things that gets lost in the shuffle all too easily is the fact that the production staff was just as much a victim as the people that they were producing. I knew our producers to do longer hours than I ever put in, ever. Like, always on call, always available. I could never do that job. And on top of that, they were asking an incredible amount of people that they knew, I believe they knew, was next to impossible. So, and I'm speaking more toward how things were at the end, but, you know, crunch happens throughout. And I think the industry is always trying to be better. It warms my heart to see people try to change, and, you know, people talk about change. I had great experiences at Telltale, but there were always, it was hard too. It was really hard too. But I think that's the one thing I'd want to highlight, is it was not just hard on the creatives. It was hard on everybody. It was hard. Everybody's a creative, and we all wanted to just make some video games together.
That's what it sounded like every time we would talk to anyone there, just like checking at GDC or coming into San Francisco, because we flirted with working at Telltale since we started like 5 years ago, 4 years ago.
Oh, you should have come.
we wanted to at first, but they didn't want to hire us because we were staying in LA. Which then we heard was like they were hiring other people who were staying in LA, and that was weird, but whatever.
Well, Eric, you had like the weirdest roller coaster ride of, I'm sure you talked about it in the last podcast or whatever, but like you're getting hired because you had no game experience, so they wouldn't hire you, and then later they'd only hire with game experience, and we went through a lot of phases.
Yeah, but like every time, even like back then, it was like a consistent thing we'd hear from people about working at Telltale was like, well, the hours are bad, the pay is not good, but you get to release a lot of stuff in a year, and like they care about writing, which especially as a young person, that sounds great.
And it was great. Like, that was the funny thing. Like, I remember, like, when I was crunching and I was working at 1 a.m. on a Saturday night, we were having a great time. Like, I was making a box for it. Like, sure, it was working, but, you know, it's crazy. And, like, and that's not to glorify crunch, because, like, crunch sucks. But it was great lemonade. If taking lemons and making lemonade is the thing. It was delicious lemonade. And there were times where it was not so delicious, but there were more times that I enjoyed it, I think, than I didn't. That's why I stayed for as long as I did.
Yeah. And we knew at least one writer who, like, recommended us not to go to Telltale after he had left, and then later joined Telltale again and went back.
I'm trying to do the math. Who is this? There's only certain people it could be. I won't say anything.
Take this out, but it was...
That sounds about right.
I have a related question to this. So you, both of you, when you were at Telltale, worked on only IP stuff. The only originals made were Puzzle Agent and Poker Night, right?
Oh, well, the only released originals.
Yeah, yes. Okay. Steven Soderbergh just did an interview this week that's really good because he was at Sundance for his movie. And
the one he shot on an iPhone?
Yeah, the second one he shot on an iPhone.
He said, if you talk to a lot of filmmakers or artists in general, there's a part of you that sometimes feels, even when you're well compensated, sometimes stupidly compensated, you feel like, I just spent a lot of time making an asset for somebody else. They own it. Not everybody is as shrewd as and forward thinking as Jim Jarmusch, who owns all of his negatives. So did you ever have that feeling working there?
All the time. All the time. I would love, like, you don't crunch on something you don't love. I can't imagine crunching on something that you didn't genuinely believe.
I could if I was getting paid enough.
God bless you. Man, I
After years of freelance, I definitely could.
God. Well, for me, it was always pretty personal, and but I am envious of that skill. And yeah, it was weird. Like, Borderlands to me means something so different than Borderlands to anybody that you ask. Or Guardians of the Galaxy is very different to me than I think what people think of. And then on top of it, you know, for the company to close and for those assets to go to somebody else, you know, it's just like so much love and blood and sweat and tears and whatever other cliche you have. Like, there was a lot of soul that went into those pieces. It's so funny because, like, from a consumer standpoint, it's like 7 out of 10 on Metacritic or whatever. But from a developer standpoint, you, like, look at all the little pieces of something that you either loved from the beginning or learned to love or made yourself love. And it's hard not to own that, you know, because you do own it in your heart. So, yes, I resonate with that deeply. Very deeply.
Yeah, no, and it definitely is something that's hard, right? Because it's like, you know, especially when you're sitting there where you're like, oh man, like I remember I had a moment where I was jotting down some ideas in a notebook and I was like, here's a great idea for a character moment. Do I want to put this into the project I'm working on? And, you know, working on a Telltale at the moment, you know, figure out a way to adapt it to being a Batman moment or whatever. Or, you know, or do I want to hang on, you know, or do I want to covetously hang on to that for myself? And I think kind of what I realized was it started to become a challenge that I would set for myself where I was like, okay, you know, I'm gonna give away this moment even though I really like it and trust that I can come up with another couple more when I need them. And it's something where I have genuinely grown to really love working with other people's IPs because I think I love that moment of and it's funny, Molly mentioned Borderlands, like the Borderlands folks are really great about this because, you know, that being like this first person shooter that was not a story focused thing. When you would tell them, like, hey, we've been thinking about the backstory and ramifications of, like, the, you know, this gun maker. And they'd be like, oh my God, literally no one's ever talked to us about that before, but we love that you guys are. And I think that's what I really like about working with an IP is it's a chance to figure out what does someone else love about the characters and world they've made, and also what are new niches and corners that you can find that maybe they didn't even know were there. But, you know, that being said, there are definitely times where you run up against that. You run up against that feeling of, like, I would love to be working on something right now that doesn't have to go through 19 layers of notes from different corporate
overlords. Oh, my God. That is true. Like, we always fantasized about that. I've still never worked on something that, like, was original to me that I could just, like, say, like, what's that left hand? What's that right hand? High five. Like,
she high five.
Approved. Yeah. But, no, I've always given everything I had, to your point, you know, like every good idea I had would go into those licensed IP games. I loved them.
Borderlands is a weird case too, where it's, you could probably ask plenty of people and they would think that their first thought of Borderlands is the Telltale game instead of the shooter.
You really think so?
Yeah.
All 10 of them.
No, that was something that was crazy, because like Borderlands had such an avid cosplay community. And I remember the feeling of as Tales from the Borderlands was coming out when we'd see photos from my cosplay contests and we'd see our characters showing and then like showing up in cosplay contests. Like that was
such Gordas.
Oh my God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like there was this amazing, like, yeah, like a Gordas someone made for their costume and a Fiona costume. And then we were just like, oh my God, they've accepted us.
That's a good memory I have. When I was the concept artist on Borderlands, I had a privacy screen because we had this open floor concept, which meant that anybody could stop by your desk and see what you're doing, and it drove me crazy because you're painting pictures and everyone wants to see. So I had a privacy screen, but my way of dealing with it was I would put up all the different fan art I kept finding for Tales from the Borderlands from Tumblr, and people would come by just to see the screen. Mm-hmm. Because it was filled with, like, this gorgeous... I'd never worked on a project that had as much fan art as Tales from the Borderlands did. And, like, it was all really good. It was, like... Yeah. And, like, the team loved to see it, too. Like, yeah. Fan art means so much. That was a magical thing about Telltale. Because we're episodic, a game was out, but still in active production. So people would be able to be fans of it while you were still making it. So as a developer, you could, like, get the shot in the arm of having people be like, yes, this is awesome. The flip side of that is, like, this sucks is really, really detrimental when you're still making something. Yeah. But
yeah. I had a really great experience with Tales where it was, like, I had this idea for, I wanted to write, like, Reese and Vaughn. I had this idea of, like, oh, like, you know, like, no one had discussed really their backstory. And I was, like, I'm going to put somewhere in there that they were roommates in college. And that, like, you know, that they were these big nerds. And then Reese was just a nerd who was handsome. And so he was able to get by where Vaughn couldn't.
I think we all know somebody like this. Where it's like, you're just a handsome nerd.
Yeah. And so it was one of those things where I was really excited. I was like, I'm going to write this in there. And it was, again, one of these things where it somehow squeaked through everything and got into the game. And then, like, people started doing fan art of Reese and Vaughn in college. And it was just one of these moments where I was like, oh, my God. Like, people took, like, that just silly little throwaway, like, 8 lines that made up that story. But suddenly there was fan art and it was real for people. And, yeah, like, the fan... I love fan art. Just the best.
This is my last question about Telltale. But it was just, who were some people over there who were killing it and why were they so good?
I think we brought up a couple of them. People like, you know, people like Chris Vossen, who was just an incredible producer that just always kept everything on the rails and was, like, just able to somehow balance, like, keeping people alive with also making a great product.
Yeah, I always think of John Stouter, who is a director that I worked with directly. But he was awesome. I think he's at ArenaNet now. Gosh, there's so many people who are so great. I don't even know how to start saying them without feeling like I'm going to miss other great people. But, like, I'll just say, like, the team of people I was working with at the end, my designers, Kevin Rich and Mandy Beninov, were amazing and so fun to work with. And, obviously, I was working with my husband. He's pretty good.
Yeah, that's me.
And, you know, Zach Keller, our lead writer, and my buddy Nicole Martinez. There's too many, like Jess Krause and Steve McManus, my actual mentor, who is the reason I'm a designer. And, you know, Ryan Kaufman, our old department chair, who let me yell in his office when I would get too angry about all the things that were happening. And just 101,000 other people in every department, you know, like the UI team was great friends, the production team was great friends. All the concept artists, Gray Rogers, who helped me adopt my cats. Like, you know, it's just like whom I learned so much from, and Derek Stratton and Jesse McCabe. And like, I can't, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I just can't. What about you?
I mean,
did I
think,
say them all?
I mean, you named about 50 people.
20,000 no, wonderful people.
No, it's funny. I think
the cinematic artists start talking about them.
Everyone came to your wedding.
Well, I think it's funny.
I'll just get that out my list.
Two people that I adored who were kind of like mainstays at Telltale who are also not good at self promotion. Randy Tudor and Mark Darren are two folks I want to give shout outs to, where I think both of them were, I want to say, among the first five employees at the company. And
both of whom, when you did something that made them proud, you would carry it home with you that night.
So Mark was the senior most designer at the company, and he just landed at Endless, I think. And he was one of the foundational members of, like, the, you know, the post Walking Dead Telltale formula.
But he was a huge founder of the Walking Dead.
I'm saying
gonna let you finish.
Yeah. It's like the post Walking Dead Telltale, like that sort of format. They Mark was one of the huge kind of creators of that format, and was just one of the most thoughtful people when it came to just like choices and things, and was also just a really great champion for people. Like when I first switched over from the cinematics department to the writing department, it was like Mark, and then also like one of his contemporaries, Dave Grossman, who like were just really, really instrumental in kind of mentoring me. And like when I said, hey, this is the thing I want to do, they didn't shoo me away. They instead said, well, okay, well, you better start working then, and here's kind of what you need to do. And so, yeah, no, I owe Mark and Dave a lot in particular.
Mark sat with me while I was still a concept artist and taught me how to do choices, just because you could tell he was interested, where he was working on a scene, and he said, you wanted to see how this works? And he just narrated it out loud to me while I sat there, like, over my lunch. Mm-hmm. He's just a sweet man. And Randy Tudor is a tough cookie,
yeah,
but when he was proud of you, you could do no wrong.
and so the thing that's so funny is, you know, obviously it was almost a meme to joke about, oh, Telltale's old creaky engine breaking down. And Telltale's engine was constantly breaking down, but the thing people didn't recognize was the fact that, like, Randy was basically the
man behind it. Duct tape and a dream.
The thing I always thought of was Scotty in Star Trek constantly yelling at the bridge for like pushing for pushing the ship to do too much, because that was Randy. Where the reason the Telltale engine was breaking all the time was because everyone was trying to do stuff with it that it was never meant to do, and so we were just.
You want a free run?
Yeah. Like. And so we were piling all this crazy stuff on top of it. And meanwhile, Randy's down in the bilge with, you know, they just being like, well, I guess I'll code this by hand. And he would. And, Randy was incredible.
Yes.
I miss that guy.
He's the origin of the incredible stash meme that permeates most Telltale games. But
yeah, that's a meme that's come up occasionally. In, like, I think it's in Walking Dead, and Minecraft.
He has a great handlebar mustache.
Yeah. Anyway.
Great man, great stash. Randy Tudor.
It's been... Bandersnatch has come out since we recorded the last episode, so we need to talk about Bandersnatch. What did you all think about it? Or first, I guess, what ending did each of you get? Also, spoilers for Bandersnatch.
Well, we got multiple endings.
What was the first one each of you got?
Oh, terrible.
Did you play together?
Bad one.
We did. It, well, so that we played with Molly's mom over the holidays.
No, she wasn't there.
Was she not?
No. She played later when we were talking about it. My mom does like games, though. Shout out to my mom. She birthed me.
we got, I think the very first ending we got was the one that almost felt like a...
No, the first ending we got was like the obvious one where we said we would work on site.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were like, this game is terrible. 0 out of 10
this
stars.
This game is bland and feels made by committee.
Does that count as an ending?
It does, because I got stars, or a lack thereof.
But credits didn't play.
That's true. Yeah.
Ooh, I don't think we ever got to credits.
We got to credits. We got, we had the trippy ending where we jumped out of a window.
Yep.
Definitely got that one. We also forced the other guy out of the window.
Yep.
But the issue was, so I wanted to win. Because they're stars, which I think there shouldn't have been, but that's a different thing.
I saw your Twitter thread.
You can join my TED Talk. But I refused to kill my dad. I was not into that. And I read later, I think you have to kill your dad to get 5 stars.
Well, at a certain point, it just does it for you.
Does
at least
he?
For me, it did.
He I kills himself?
No, the game, it doesn't give you the choice. It just kills him.
Oh, no. Really?
Stefan just picks up the ashtray and whacks him
outside of player control.
Yes. It happened at least once with me. Because I chose the first time not to kill him.
That's interesting.
You know, the thing that was so tough about that, because, like, I remember reading, because, you know, obviously, I've been hearing kind of the rumors, like, oh, there's going to be a Black Mirror Interactive thing and all that jazz. And then the description of it came out that it was rooted around a Choose Your Own Adventure book, and it was, you know, as I kind of alluded to earlier, like, it's a bummer that that's the point of reference everyone goes to, because it's just kind of, it's such a fundamentally tactical and not character-based way of doing choices. And so I saw that, and I was like, oh, okay, so that's kind of what they're doing. But I still went kind of optimistic, and I think ultimately there was a lot of really interesting ideas. I fundamentally wish that it had been about... I wish it didn't have to be meta about interactivity.
Yeah, I didn't... I did cringe a bit when they when you had to talk about Netflix within the game. I'm always going to call it a game.
What do you call it, an experience?
An interactive experience. I will say I liked it. I did like it. You know, I thought it was really amazing. Like, the novelty of seeing a choice-based experience shot with real humans beautifully with an amazing soundtrack. With a budget. Yeah, it was amazing. Like, and it was something that, like, I've always been really interested in. Even back when we were at Telltale, it was something that I'd kind of inquired about, because Telltale games were never hard enough for a core gamer base, but they were never easy enough for, say, you know, like, my mother to enjoy playing them. And this is an example of an interactive experience that anyone can enjoy, you know, where choices really are the core mechanic. So I was all about that. But I think I said it before, but, you know, like, the issue with the star system is, you know, like, when there's a good ending and a bad ending, then you just spend your life trying to reverse engineer the author's intent rather than divining or creating your own experience. And for me, like, the reason I got into branching narrative and I love those games so much is every game that I've either played or been a part of creating, I've seen it as an opportunity for the player to tell their own story. And so that's difficult for me to get past. Like, I want to be able to offer everybody the opportunity to believe that they have made their own version of events. And when you put a star system on that, it really fundamentally will make them feel like they got a worse version than somebody else. So not a huge fan of that. But overall, you know, cool thing. Very cool thing.
It's going to be really interesting to kind of see what starts happening next, because it reminds me of, like, when movies first started being talkies, and then every talkie was about, like, it's about a singer, it's about it, like, and there was all these plot lines that were about sound, and that's kind of what it feels like we're at with interactivity right now, where it's like an interactive story is always
about... Choice game about choice.
Yeah, exactly, like, oh, and then, like, you're controlling a character, but the character's fighting your choices, and it kind of feels like we're at that phase right now.
You gotta get past.
Yeah, now that, but what's really exciting is, now that Bandersnatch is the thing that's out there that can be played, but that can be so easily played by anybody... It's really great because, you know, like, you know, when I'm out having conversations about, like, interactive storytelling, Bandersnatch is finally a point of reference that kind of everyone has that's post Choose Your Own Adventure books.
Yeah.
And it's nice that it's creating a new kind of shared language for people.
One of the things I do like that it does is I really liked when you pick to work in-house and it's the wrong answer. I like how their abbreviated recap of events that shows some things happening slightly differently.
And, yeah, it's still giving you more info.
I thought that was very interesting. I didn't think it got consistently used, but it was like...
Yeah.
Because one of the things that makes it fundamentally different from a Choose Your Own Adventure book is I can skim a Choose Your Own Adventure book, so I can move quickly through that content and refamiliarize myself with it without wasting a ton of time. But a show, like, you have to watch it again, you know, and that's fatigue. Like, that's the frustration bucket thing again. But I thought it was really clever that they figured out a way to do that and also show you something different where it's like, oh, by replaying this, you're actually building on this strange thing that's happening, this Black Mirror-y thing.
Yeah.
I liked that quite a bit. I wish they'd used it more.
I'm sure they will. How did you two feel about fail states being in there?
I'm of two minds on fail states. I think I'm sorry, I feel like I'm talking a lot, but I have strong feelings about fail states.
He's been on before. You haven't.
It's true.
I feel like fail states are useful because they provide stakes. Stakes are important in any kind of participatory experience. If you're going to jump out the window, you need to know that you might die. So on one hand, I like them, but on the other hand, a video game would just let you start at the window again, whereas this, you know, forces you to reevaluate a lot of the material you've played before. So I'm still kind of torn. Like, I like fail states. Like, I didn't used to like them. I used to be really against them. I just wanted soft fails all the time. But I can see why they exist. I'm not sure they were being used to their fullest extent here.
I think the one thing that's tough with fail states is, in a piece of content like Bandersnatch or another like bit of interactive media, is it's the difference between sort of like, you know, saying to a player, viewer, whatever you want to call them, like, hey, let's build this story as we go. Do you want this piece or do you want this piece? Do you want this piece or do you want this piece? And kind of letting them build their story. And then at the end, getting a step back and say, oh, there's my story. Versus, you know, the model where it's like, oh, I got 19 different fails and then I finally got to the end. And it kind of leaves people with that feeling of like, well, what's the, you know, quote unquote canon ending? And it's interesting because Netflix, besides Bandersnatch, they've had a couple of different instances of either series or shows that have had sort of one-off interactive episodes, more on the kids' side of things. But like, for instance, there was the show Stretch Armstrong and the Flex Fighters that had an interactive episode. And that was an interesting thing because they ran into the problem of, like, you know, it's one episode in the middle of, like, the rest of a season. So kind of what is the canon version of that and how do you keep going? And it created kind of a state where because they didn't have fail states, you know, but they had multiple endings, they had to sort of trunk everything and soften it at the end to make sure that it still fit with the rest of the series. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, like Molly said, I'm definitely of two minds on the fail states thing because on the one hand, it doesn't feel great to say to a player, like, nope, wrong choice. But on the other hand, it is nice to have that just very reactive feeling of like, oh, this really is it makes the choices that you make that don't end in failures feel better.
Feel more rewarding.
Yeah.
I thought of an example of a game that kind of feels similar, which was Until Dawn, you know, came out a while ago now. But with the horror element, which I don't think is like totally dissimilar to the Black Mirror thing, I feel like Bandersnatch was more psychological, but like it's in the same vein. Fail states in Until Dawn were scary. Like they were disturbing in a way. And that character remained gone. Like if you killed a character, they were dead and you felt their absence. And I think that that's an interesting way to do it where a fail state, it is a fail state, but it does not result in a restart, but it does result in you being acutely aware as the viewer or player that you have done something that has altered the content.
Yeah.
It's expensive, very expensive. Although I would still love to look at how Until Dawn worked. Like I played that game a few times as like a Telltale employee and a branching narrative enthusiast. And I still don't fully understand how some of their trunking, we always call it branches and trunking, like when they come back together. I don't fully understand how all their trunking works, but it's really good. I mean, the fact that you don't understand it makes it delicious, doesn't it?
So. Graham, one of the writers, has said that the script is 10,000 pages long.
Oh, Until Dawn? Does not shock me in the least. That's like a 6-hour, 7-hour game, right?
Yeah, that's a long game.
It's quite long. Our scripts were like 3,000, and they were only an hour and a half, right?
Something like that.
Anyway, that does not shock me. If anything, I expect it to be longer.
So the Hollywood Reporter was not a huge fan of Bandersnatch.
Oh, no.
And I want to talk about one section of their review. Quote, as the movie's second half ramps up and flies completely off the rails, it becomes clear just how little your choices mattered earlier on. A common pitfall in choice-based narrative. The story is less like a tree full of branching paths and more like a cleverly disguised straight line with 3 or 4 distinctive forks that affect which of the endings you get, end quote. And I just thought, aren't the majority of choice-based narratives more like cleverly disguised straight lines with 3 or 4 distinctive forks? And like the branching trees is like the ideal, but is rarely what anyone does.
Do you want to go?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that's so tough is it's like, you know, it's that whole idea that a branching narrative really is only as impactful as sort of like it feels impactful to the person in the moment, you know, where it's like something I kind of started to realize is at Telltale, we started experimenting with this thing where we had a couple series where we'd have episode fives, you know, because in our five episode series, we'd have episode fives that would be super branchy. Sometimes the effect of having like two entirely different episodes based on choices you'd made, and people didn't really notice or seem to care because by that point they felt like, oh, I felt like my choices didn't really matter up until now, so whatever. And so it actually started showing that like the most impact, you'd get the most impact when you'd have a lot of branching right up front and make people feel like, oh man, my choices are really mattering like in this thing. And then you get them emotionally invested. And then if it kind of starts to become more linear as time goes on with, you know, the smaller forks, you know, then it had people's investment by that point.
I feel like there's two. So I don't super disagree with you. Like most branching narrative is fundamentally not a straight line, but, you know, there's
it's more limited than you would expect.
It's a big limb.
Yeah.
But I feel like there are two key tricks that you have at your disposal to obfuscating that. One is this idea of, it's kind of what Eric was talking about. There's a way to, psychologically, there's a way that people perceive content. And this is something that I feel like I'm familiar with because of the aforementioned think tank nature of Telltale. Like, we tracked all of our choices. We had metrics for things. It didn't really influence how we set up our choice spaces, but I had a lot of data to look at to be like, okay, most players will fundamentally play good. So rather than offer a black and a white choice, I'm going to offer shades of gray that lean toward good because that's going to be a more compelling choice space or different things like that. But the two core tools in your disposal are one, I've heard it referred to as beads on a string, but to Eric's point, it's where you have a branch point that collapses and then another branch point that collapses. And so sometimes you can even, I call the linear path through a piece of content the spine. Sometimes you can even have two spines, and I'm gesticulating wildly with my hands as I say this. You can have two spines that you ping pong between. So you have two, like, this is the fanciest version. You can kind of have two core plot lines. And in Guardians of the Galaxy, it actually kind of did this. You have two core plot lines that you're bouncing between, and you can jump from one rail onto the other. And that can obfuscate it. But even if you don't, if you just have one line where it's out in a binary branch and then back in collapsing and then out again, even that action can kind of obfuscate it. And the second tool is player investment in the protagonist. And this is something that I think is fundamentally difficult with interactive streaming media. Not impossible, but in a game, like an RPG, I can build a player character. I'm thinking of a BioWare game, like say I'm playing Dragon Age. I build my character, I decide what kind of person I am. I might even have an origin story. I romance the other characters, like I decide who to kiss, I save the world, I do all this stuff, and like I have huge investment in a character that I've cultivated that has choice space. So on top of the fact that we have these maybe two spines or these beads on a string jumping between, I also have this fundamental buy-in in that I have relationships with other characters and I have a sense of self. And so when you combine those two things together, you can kind of create enough smoke and mirrors that I think for a lot of people, they just don't quite, it's enough. You know, where even though there's only so many ways I can end Mass Effect, there's only like one. My Commander Shepard is a very different person than your Commander Shepard. And like the things I care about and the things I think are important to her or him are very different or potentially different. So I think, like, those two things, it's the technical aspect of figuring out where to put your choices and how to branch them effectively and cost-effectively within scope, but also how to build investment in a player character or POV protagonist. And you can do that even with a not homegrown one. You know, like, you can have a point-of-view protagonist, like, what was his name in Bandersnatch? Stefan?
Yeah.
Stefan.
I could get invested in him. You know, like, I get invested
in... I was in Dunkirk. I liked him.
Yeah, I'm invested in Nathan Drake and Joel. You know, like, I can be invested in a pre-baked protagonist as well. You just kind of have to put myself in a place where I can kind of... The player needs to settle into understanding what that player cares about, what the character cares about, and then putting them on the same equal footing and letting them start driving, ease them into the driver's seat. So,
well, and yeah, I think it's an interesting thing where it's like part of being in the kind of still being in a little bit of the gimmicky phase of interactive media. I think there's this feeling that people want to know, well, how many endings are there, and like how many different pathways are
there? Did they say like 9 million? Is some crazy
well,
number?
And that's the thing, right? Is it's like we're still in this phase where people love to throw around how many different permutations there are, and it's always some bonkers number of like, you know, 33 million or something like that. And I kind of went down this rabbit hole of looking at a lot of the obsession with multiple endings started coming out around the same time that, like, achievement hunting became a really big thing in video games, where there was kind of this big... It was the first Infamous, where there were different achievements based on which of the endings you got. And what's funny is I think that kind of kicked off this feeling of, like, oh, man, like, you needed to replay that game multiple times to get the different achievements and the different endings. Like, and you know, I'm not going to say...
Sounding like an old man shaking his fist at a cloud
No, they just more. I find it really fascinating because...
It's just when you were young, you know, games were different.
I find it really interesting because I'm not a person that's really motivated by, like, achievements in games. Like, the idea of filling out an achievements list and getting that plat isn't something that really that really motivates me a ton. And so it's something I've really tried to understand, though, like, for players that is really important, because at Telltale, like, our for the most part, and with only a couple of exceptions, our achievements were usually baked into, like, the kind of chapter headings. And so, you know, you could just play through the game once and then get the complete game achievement. And it was interesting because I had a chat with someone where they were like, oh, well, you know, I would have gone back to try and get multiple endings, but I didn't see the point because you know, I had already gotten the achievement for playing through it once. I thought that was so interesting because then you read an article like Hollywood Reporter where what they're clearly kind of saying is like, oh, you know, I wanted an ending that felt just as emotionally, like, you know, because like Molly was saying, there's really the one ending that Bandersnatch was trying to guide you towards. And when you got that one, it's like, man, now I have had the emotional experience and the catharsis that this was trying to guide me on. And I think it's interesting because, yeah, it basically means you have to keep doing kind of all these dead ends. Like, nope, that wasn't it. That wasn't it. That wasn't it.
It's like, at that point, why isn't it just a movie?
How do you know when you've completed? Yeah.
Yeah. But that was something I was thinking about is I was like, man, what would that have been like if it was like basically if someone was filming me playing it? And then it was just a non-interactive watching someone try and do like that, and so they just wondering like, would that have had the same emotional impact?
Can I tell a story? Is that okay?
Yeah. Is it a good story?
Well, I think it's a good story, but it comes back to like what Eric is talking about, where it's like I think it's important to be able to build a story. And for instance, in Bandersnatch, when I had released the terrible game because I worked in office, the credits had rolled. Like, that would have been... That's weirdly a litmus test, right? If that's unsatisfying, then don't offer that branch. Yeah. Is kind of how I feel about it. But I wanted to just offer... This is one of my favorite stories. It does involve a BioWare game. Sorry, I'm on a BioWare kick. About building your own story. Because I played Dragon Age Origins around the same time as a good friend of mine. And we're both romancing the same guy. And I had lucked into, like, there's so many hoops you have to jump through to romance Alistair in BioWare, in Dragon Age Origins, and I had happened to roll, like, the right origin, and I'd done everything right, and, like, it somehow just lucked into becoming Queen of Ferelden, and I felt very good, and I would tell everybody about it, about how lucky and how awesome my playstyle was that I had done this. And so I beat that game, and I was like, I had the guy, I was the queen, like, I was, like, I killed the archdemon, it was great. And my friend beat it around the same time, and I was like, oh my god, Sharong, like, tell me, like, what happened, because she was romancing Alistair, too, and she was like, oh, well, he died killing the archdemon to save my life, and my ending scene was his funeral, And I was just like, what? Like, I was like, do you want to, like, maybe replay a little bit? And, like, that's a late game choice you made that had that happen. Like, you probably could go back and change that. And she was like, she looked at me completely deadpan, like she didn't play a lot of games. And she was just like, why would I do that? Like, that's true. Like, that's what happened.
Yeah.
Like, I can't change it. Like, I made the best choices I could, and that's what happened.
She didn't feel the need to min-max her Alistair time.
No, like, to her, it never even occurred to her that there were multiple endings. There was one canonical ending, which was what she had done. Like, she made all the choices from a point of, from her point of view. Like, she did the best she had. Didn't look up anything in a wiki. And I always look at that, and I was just like, wow, like, that's heartbreaking. You probably invested 60 hours into that game, and, you know, like, your romance dies in the very last moments, and you're like, that's good. That's a good experience. But I always look at that, and I'm just like, that is what I want to shoot for. Like, I want to create an ending so powerful that you could lose everything at the end of a 60-hour experience and be like, I've had sufficient. I feel whole. So, like, when I look at things like Bandersnatch, I'm just like, okay, if BioWare can do that with a 60-hour game, then we can find a way to make that out of an hour-and-a-half experience. I believe it is possible.
And, like, we haven't played Dragon Age Origins.
Romance Alistair, it's so good.
Everyone, yeah. Like, what you're describing, all of it sounds thematically consistent the entire time, even if that ending, like, would make someone unhappy. It's like, no, that... It fits, like, it feels right, which is what I wanted out of Bandersnatch, but the ending I got was like, I don't understand. This does not feel like the story I was going towards.
We should do another podcast, and I'll just talk about Dragon Age Origins.
I wrote down Dragon Age episode. We just have so many people to come on here and talk about Dragon Age, just have, like, half Dragon Age writers and, like, creators of the game and half fans of the game just like to meet
actually,
each other.
Yeah, I think just sticking Molly and Sarah on the mics together and just say Dragon Age.
Yeah.
That'll be 4 hours.
I'll explain, like,
4 hours right
you can
there.
Harden characters in that. Do you even know what that means?
That sounds dirty.
You can take characters that start on one character arc and you can do things, make choices that change their personality midway through the game and make them evaluate choices differently.
Sounds nice.
They're like people. Anyway, another podcast.
I can do one last question. What makes a good choice?
Well, so I'll give you my textbook professorial answer, but I'm sure there's
some fun. And then
your
street answer.
I'll give him a street answer. A great choice. The simplest way to make a great choice is a great choice constitutes something that immediately reacts to you in the moment. So, you know, I decide something, I'm going to do one thing or another thing. It has to have an immediate payoff, feels reactive to you. It has to be well broadcasted. I have to understand what I'm choosing between. So, and then a great choice has consequence. So you've got A, it's well broadcasted. B, it has an immediate reaction. So if I turned off the game right now, I'd still feel good about the choice. And C, down the line, it has an unintended consequence or maybe intended consequence. Either way, it has payoff down the line. If it has all three of those components, you've got a great choice. Ideally, I think you'll find it difficult to execute on all three of those points if the choice doesn't have an emotion attached to it or something personal about it. You usually can't capitalize on all of those if you're choosing to go between one door and another door.
Yeah.
Sorry, my street answer, though?
Sure.
Best choices are when you piss somebody off and then give them the choice that they want to say when they're pissed off. We call that, like, a feeder line. So, like, an example would be, like, I have a character who just, like, disses you really hard. And then I give you a choice to basically burn them right back, nestled in the wheel. Like, you'll look through, like, you don't put it as the first choice. You maybe put it as the second choice, but definitely the third is a good one where it's like you're looking and then you just see the thing you want to say and it feels so good. That's usually teeing the player up with, like, that amazing feeder line, like, I bet you can't do this, and, like, you know you can, and then you see the choice in the wheel and it says, yes, I can, and you're like, yes!
And I think that comes to something that, like, you can also reverse engineer choices to feel better, too, where I usually find it's have an NPC make an assumption about you, and it's a quick way to elicit that emotional
That's
response.
That's a better version.
That Molly's talking about, where it's the idea that it's like, if a character says, so like, let's say for instance, a character says, we need to go, we need to jump through the warp gate, but it's impossible. And then your choices are, well, let me try. And then like, you know, then or like, oh yeah, you're right. That is impossible. Versus if the character says to you, we need to jump through that warp gate, but there's no way you can do that. Immediately, that's immediately that more powerful choice, because they're putting on this assumption where it's like, I assume that you're going to chicken out on this. And so that's what Molly's saying, where you can either say like, yeah, you're right, I am going to chicken out on that, or like, screw you, I'm going
to
do it.
I'll yes and you, because you bought me the 30 seconds to think of one. Like, a great feeder is like, there's no denying it. I know you like him. Now, that's delicious. Like, either my player is like, how did you know? Or it's like, you, no, of course not. Like, I know, like, the different places you're going to be. So when I put those on the wheel, you're like, that's the one. Like, you knew. Like, you knew that's what I wanted to say. Finding those fun tee-ups, like, that's the fun hacking of making great choices. I love doing that. So cheap, but I love doing it. You can't do it too much, but sometimes.
That is a good spot to end this on. So where can people find you on the internet? You want to say your Twitter handles?
Sure. On Twitter, I'm Stirpicus. That's Stirpicus.
And on Twitter, I am Lian, because my name is Molly Ann. So it's LLYANN.
And you can find this podcast at ScriptBlockCast on Twitter.
Our album art is by Lily Nishida, at Lily Nishida on Twitter. And our music is by Tumello, at Tumello Makes on Twitter. That's number 2 MELLO Makes.
Please leave us a review on iTunes. And that is it. Thank you, too, for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thanks, fellas. This is fun.
Thank you so much.